I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
So the key things with Mama was education, respect.
She had such an early impression on my life, whereas, you know, most kids see their grandmother every now and again. I was with her all day, every day.
She was a big sports fan. You know, people might not know she loved the Jacksonville Jaguars and loved to watch football.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. Welcome to a special episode, a supplement to Season 1, the Isaiah Nixon story. Today we want to bring you some new information and add some dimensions to the story you heard in that first season. Now, if you didn't listen to the first season's episodes, please feel free to stay with us, then go back and catch up on them. Our focus in that first season was on Isaiah Nixon, 28 years old, a son, a husband, a father of six children, a black farmer in rural Georgia, who was killed in 1948 by two white men because he dared to vote. And in those stories, you heard from Mr. Nixon's wife, Sally, and even more so from his daughter, Dorothy. Today, our focus is on Isaiah Nixon's widow, Sally Nixon, a woman about 5'1" in stature, but large in spirit, strength, and willpower. Sally Mama. That's the confection her children and grandchildren always use when they speak of her. Sally Mama. This past April, on the anniversary of Isaiah Nixon's death, Sally had lived 72 years after he died. She'd outlived her two husbands and most of her children. I'm pleased to say that all the insults and cruelties and tragedies of the Jim Crow South that were inflicted on Sally Nixon and women of her generation were not able to break her or kill her. But I'm sorry to report that COVID-19 did. Sally Nixon died July 25th, 2020, in Jacksonville, Florida, where she'd moved soon after Isaiah Nixon died and was buried back in Georgia. She was 96 years old. She was a remarkable person, much admired and beloved by her family. At times, her children and grandchildren may have found her a little bit intimidating because she was strict. She pushed personal achievement, and she spoke bluntly, but they never doubted her love. Just my view, the person I met in February 2017 while conducting research for the first season of Buried Truths was delightful. She made me laugh.
How are you?
Just fine.
My name is Hank Klibanoff.
My name is Sally.
I know. It's so good to meet you. It's an honor to meet you.
I'm so glad you could make it.
I had gone to Jacksonville, Florida with three goals. One was to meet and interview this woman, Sally Nixon, who just celebrated her 93rd birthday. My students at the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory University had done extensive and impressive research on the killing of her husband and its historical context. And I wanted to talk to her because I just could not fathom what it was like in a small Georgia town in 1948 for a black woman of only 25 years with six children, one of them less than 2 weeks old, to endure the horror of watching two white men with guns in their hands and menace in their voices approach her husband in front of the family farmhouse. She watched as they asked her husband if he'd voted that day, and then who for. She saw the white men, unhappy with his answers, move closer while her husband stepped backward. Then she saw the men begin firing their guns into her husband's body, and all she could do was yell, "Fall, Isaiah, fall!" And he did, but only after being mortally wounded. He died 2 days later, two counties away, in the closest hospital that would care for a black patient. So I had come to see her, and I had brought something I wanted her to see. The second goal of that trip was to meet and interview Keith Johnson, nephew of the two men who killed Isaiah Nixon. Keith Johnson, after learning about some of the Civil Rights Cold Cases Project's findings, had reached out to me, saying he wanted to apologize to the Nixon family for what his uncles had done more than six decades earlier. I wasn't sure what to think. Of all the cities in the world he could be living in, he, too, lived in Jacksonville? Was I a little suspicious? Yeah, at first. But after several conversations with him, not any longer. He wanted me to introduce him to Dorothy Nixon Williams, Isaiah and Sally Nixon's daughter, who was only 6 years old when she saw Keith's uncles kill her father. The third goal was to see if Dorothy might relax her, well, I don't want to call it resistance, but her reluctance to meet Keith Johnson and to hear his apology. Now, that weekend came flooding back into my mind a few days ago in late July when I got a Friday night text message from Joy Williams. She's Dorothy's daughter, Sally's granddaughter. "I just wanted to let you know that my grandmother, Sally, was placed in hospice care last night. She tested positive for COVID-19 a couple of weeks ago." Oh, how that hurt me when I read those words. I spoke the following day by Zoom with Dorothy and Joy. We were joined on the call by Ellie Studdard, a former student in my Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases class at Emory, which is where the core research for buried truths is done. Ellie, by the way, is headed into her third year at Duke Law. Now, Ellie, you may recall, well, in case anyone is listening who didn't hear the first season, let me be cryptic and put it this way. Ellie's the one whose amazing discovery deep in the Georgia woods ended a 67-year mystery for the Nixon family. So, back to that call. The four of us, Dorothy, Joy, Ellie, and I, had a good conversation that lingered after it ended. And then the present intruded. 20 minutes after we got off the Zoom, Dorothy got a call. Sally had died. Even before the Nixons left Georgia in 1948, their sad plight, a family left fatherless and without income by the murderous hand of Jim Crow, had been given high-profile coverage in stories and photographs by the Pittsburgh Courier, a black-owned weekly newspaper. Now, this was no small matter. The Pittsburgh Courier was the most widely circulated black newspaper in the U.S. and was aggressive covering civil rights in the South. Each week, loaded onto buses, thousands of Pittsburgh couriers would be dropped off at black shops and mom-and-pop stores and beauty salons across the South. The Nixons moved to Jacksonville because they had family there, and the Courier was not far behind. Their reporters and photographers came to town and saw all eight of the surviving Nixons. Isaiah Nixon's mother, Daisy Davis, who was known as Ma Daisy, Sally, and the six children, had been forced into terrible, cramped living conditions. So, when the Courier and its publisher, Mrs. Jessie Van, created a campaign to raise contributions for the Nixon family, the money rolled in, enough to build them a new house in Jacksonville. A famous black architect in Los Angeles, Paul R. Williams, who had designed homes for celebrities like Frank Sinatra, Lucille Ball, Danny Thomas, agreed to develop the plans for the Nixon's home. So I want you to know that Sally Nixon lived in that Jacksonville home for about 60 years, from the time it was built in 1949 until about 2010, when she moved into an assisted living facility. Now think about it. The family unit that existed in Alston, Georgia, picked up, moved to Jacksonville, and they all moved into the same home. And it stayed in the same family for all those years. So that's the kind of stable, steadfast, unswerving life that existed in the family before and after Isaiah Nixon was killed. For Sally's children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, cousins, in-laws, everyone who carried the DNA of Isaiah and Sally Nixon, that home was the nexus of all things good in the Nixon family's new life. And its beating heart was Sally's kingdom, the kitchen.
And, you know, obviously the kitchen was a place of community in her house.
This is Joy Williams, Sally's granddaughter, Dorothy's daughter.
That's where everybody gathered. Not a very big place, but just still, you know, always family there. She loved to cook, and so she was a fantastic cook. We have a big family, so all of our cousins, and we would always be gathering, and it usually food was at the center of it. And it was just the way that she shared love with us was through her cooking.
And so gatherings in the kitchen, every meal sounds like was a celebration.
It was. She never really cooked a small meal.
Sally's talents in the kitchen, particularly her baking, helped her get a job when she needed health insurance. And that job, in turn, would lead her rebellious daughter, Dorothy, to a defining moment in her life, the decision to go to college. So Sally went to work at a Morrison's cafeteria in Jacksonville. And I can tell you from personal experience that Morrison's cafeterias, which were Southern-born and became the largest cafeteria chain in the nation, were something to behold. I mean, they were bright, they were clean, and for me as a young boy with my wide-eyed peripheral vision, the number of food offerings was staggering. I also want to add as an aside, because I do tend to veer off a bit into history, that Morrison's across the South was also known as the restaurant chain most rapidly resistant to allowing or serving black customers. Nobody, including governors seeking some small concession, could persuade Morrison's owners to bend on that. Civil rights icon and congressman John Lewis, who just died, discovered as a young man how ferociously Morrison's resisted when he led an effort in Nashville to force the cafeteria to serve blacks in 1964. Nashville police responded with clubs swinging bloody violence on the street outside Morrison's, and John Lewis was the first demonstrator arrested. Of course, Sally Nixon was not trying to get served there. She was just working there in the kitchen, making desserts and baked goods. And at home, she was getting from Dorothy what today we'd call attitude.
My mom was more like the sergeant in the house. You know, we had to do what she said do. She was a good mom. She was really gung-ho about education. So Mama just had a little bit, the fifth grade as a matter of fact. But they didn't give us any slack with education. And we had to make great grades. She encouraged activities, and I was in the band, a major ed, honor society, just everything. And as far as a real nurturer, like my grandmother was really the nurturer. She was there. She handle problems. Mama just tell you how it's going to be done, and it was done.
What Sally the sergeant drilled most was the value of education. Out of the 6 Nixon children, 4 went to college, 3 got advanced degrees. And Dorothy, as we explained in season 1, got her bachelor's degree in nursing from Florida A&M University and her master's in nursing from the University of Maryland, on her way to a career as a psychiatric nurse. But that took some doing on Sally's part to coax, even trick Dorothy into seeing the value of a college education.
I was a little difficult at times because I was an excellent student, but I was kind of, I'll do it if I want to do it kind of a thing sometimes. For me, I said, I'll go to college if I want to. I'll get out and get married if I want to. And that's kind of the way I talked at the time. You know what she did? She got me a job leading into my senior year at Morrison Cafeteria where she was working. I had to go upstairs, and I had to pull meat off the bones. But during that time, everything was natural. We didn't have all these foods that come in at restaurants, and it's almost ready to go. We had to pull the meat off the bones to make the salads and so on and so forth. And I was standing up there doing that. I said, darn, I really don't like this, but I didn't know the lesson she was trying to teach me yet. So at lunchtime, I had to go on the line, and I had to serve drinks. And then one man said, and I mean, it was so awful the way he said it, with girl, bring me some more tea. And I want it now. And he was just hollering at me, and I'm saying, okay, I took him some tea and so forth. And then I get back, and he's demanding this and that, and then I told my mama when we got home, I said, I want to go to college. She said, now you see, this is something you will be doing the rest of your life. You're going to either be waiting on people and cooking for them, or you're going to be in their house cleaning. And that was a big lesson for me. And she had a purpose for doing it. Because she still had goals in mind, and that goal, you're going to get an education. You're going to go to college. Yeah. I'll never forget that. Never.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at georgiahealthinitiative.org.
I've heard over and over again this idea that Sally would encourage her children and grandchildren to be what they wanted to be and to be the best they could at it. Joy in particular felt that. She'd started playing basketball in the 5th grade and had been a basketball star at the University of South Florida. But her post-college direction was more in line with her academic studies, retail marketing. She was 2 years into getting a foothold in marketing when she got an invitation to be an assistant coach at the college level. By then, both Sally Mama and Dorothy, who'd seen more of Joy's games than they could count, were fully behind her choice. Joy has never looked back. She's still coaching varsity basketball, now at Clemson. But here's what her family will also tell you about Sally Mama.
Yeah, she didn't mince words.
This is Dorothy's son, Joy's younger brother, Tony Williams. He's a senior account executive at a telecommunications company in Orlando. For the first couple of years of his life, when Dorothy was at Maryland getting her master's degree and his father had a demanding job, Tony went to live with Sally in the family home.
She and my mother have that trait in common that you really don't have to, there's no gray area in terms of where she stands. If you ask, she'll tell you exactly how she's feeling. And more often than not, sometimes you didn't have to ask.
And here again is Joy Williams. Now, she's Sally's granddaughter.
She was feisty still. I mean, we were doing the FaceTimes with her, you know, since mid-March. And so one of the calls, she was watching the news. And so my mom asked her, she said, have you been watching your president? And she said, yeah, I've been watching him. And so my mom asked her, she said, Mama, if you could say one thing to the president, what would you say? She said, I wouldn't say one word. I wouldn't say anything. I would just knock the hell out of it. I said, oh my gosh.
So here's how I witnessed Sally's blunt talk when I met her. If you heard season one, you may recall that the two men who killed Isaiah Nixon, the Johnson brothers, had grown up with Nixon, had actually eaten in Sally's home when they were kids. Now, I was born in Alabama in the late 1940s and have lived in the South well over half my life. So I know that some white people, especially if they were juiced up by some white supremacist political demagogue like Jean Talmadge in the late 1940s, would find their white skin a tighter bond than a childhood friendship. I know it, but I don't fully understand it. So I wanted to ask Sally.
It's still hard to understand why two men who thought of themselves as friends would have killed your husband.
It's hard for you to understand. Because you're not like that.
Right.
We just know it wasn't hard for us to understand. Well, we know what kind of people they were. They had two faces, a good face and another face.
And here's how I experienced Sally's sharp tongue. I was reminding her of the political background in 1948. Jean Talmadge had served 3 terms as governor. He'd been elected to a 4th, but died before he could serve. Jean Talmadge's son, Herman, was running in 1948. He's the one Isaiah Nixon voted against. So I'm setting all this up.
And the man on the ballot was a Talmadge.
Who?
As I explained it, Sally looked at me and all of my whiteness, and then she sharply interrupted me, though with a small smile.
Yeah, y'all put him in there.
Indeed, we white people did put Jean Talmadge in there. In office, and his son Herman, and Marvin Griffin, and George Wallace, and Ross Barnett, and Richard Russell, and Jim Eastland, and on and on and on, decades of white supremacists to whom the Isaiah Nixons of the South meant absolutely nothing. I said earlier that on the day that I visited with Sally Nixon in Jacksonville, I brought something for her. It was a video of a very popular, nationally televised show she'd been featured in back in 1953, but had never seen. Kate Sweeney, the initial producer of Barry Truce, had found and acquired it. The show was This Is Your Life, hosted by Ralph Edwards.
This is Your Life, America's most talked about program, is brought to you.
And if you're not familiar with this old television program, the premise was simple. They invite a notable person on and have people from that person's past talk about their memories of them. And on this particular night, they were showcasing the Pittsburgh Courier and the work of Jesse Vance.
I thought I was here to do a job.
Well,
as the show looked back at the life of Jesse Vann, they needed people to not just talk about her, but to attest to her character. And to do this, the show would usually feature an old friend, a co-worker, and in the case of Jesse Vann, they'd bring in someone she had helped. Helped when they were down, when they needed a new start, a new home. Yes, on this particular episode, they'd invited Isaiah Nixon's wife, his widow, Sally Nixon.
And that woman will never forget it either.
You know who that is, Mrs. Vann?
It must be Sally Nixon.
The woman you raised funds to help.
Let me just point out, here's another history aside, that Ralph Edwards, This Is Your Life, and its sponsors all seem to have had no qualms in 1953 about honoring a black woman on a nationally televised show a year before the Supreme Court's decision desegregating schools in America.
Well, after my husband got killed in Georgia, Mrs. Van put a plea in the Pittsburgh Courier to help us.
Yes. A response came from every race in all parts of the country.
The faint-voiced Sally Nixon you just heard is not as full-throated as the drill sergeant back home. Sally Nixon's passing revealed to me some things I did not know. Let me take you back to that weekend in 2017 in Jacksonville. I interviewed Keith Johnson, who repeated that he wanted to meet Dorothy, to apologize for what his uncles had done. Years earlier, he'd sought out Sally on his own. He'd found her and had apologized to her. But her acuity had been starting to slip, and he was pretty sure she didn't fully grasp who he was or what he was saying. When Sally told Dorothy that someone from the family of the men who killed Isaiah had come by to talk, even Dorothy wasn't quite sure whether to believe it. Keith told me he wanted a fresh chance with the Nixon family, with Dorothy. Months earlier, Dorothy had said she wasn't ready to meet Keith and didn't know when or even if she would be. Then weeks before our arrival, she'd begun to soften. And then just before we arrived in Jacksonville, Dorothy said that if we met with Keith and we thought he was okay and sincere, she'd probably consent to meet with him. And that's what happened.
Hey.
Well, hello there.
How are you?
All right.
It's
how
nice
are
to
you?
Meet you. May I give you a hug?
Sure. So nice to meet you.
After Keith's apology and Dorothy's acceptance, their small talk revealed that one of Keith's best friends in Jacksonville had been one of her son Tony's best friends in high school. Quite quickly, they were strangers no more. The meeting ended in another hug. The relationships not only did not end, but they expanded. Keith and Dorothy became friends on Facebook. Then Tony, who'd grown up in Jacksonville, called Keith to thank him for persevering in delivering an apology to the Nixon family.
I'd reached out to Keith around the time the podcast was finishing up and thanked him at that point for helping bring a sense of closure to everything that she had experienced from when she was a little girl. So I felt that it was time to take that to the next level and meet him.
Tony had another experience I want to share with you. Shortly after that first season of Barry Truce was released, Tony began putting up some posts on Facebook about his grandfather Isaiah, about Alston, about the 1948 killing, his family having to pack up and leave Georgia, all that. He, of course, expressed great pride in his grandfather. Well, this was quite a revelation to many of his friends.
It helped a lot of my friends that I grew up with, because Joey and I went to a private school in Jacksonville, predominantly white, and, you know, some 30, 35 years later that we finished high school, the story of my grandfather just completely blew the minds of a lot of folks that we grew up with for a very long time who aren't African American. And I think it helped them gain some perspective of our journey, our history, how we got to Jacksonville in the first place, how we even got to meet him and become friends and learn of different races, different cultures, different customs, and so forth. It's brought a sense of awareness that I don't think they would have gotten otherwise.
And this is just in the last couple of months, you mean, the stuff you were posting?
Right. And Joy and I posted news of the podcast when it became available, you know, mm-hmm. It was in 2018.
Right.
So I remember driving to work listening to that every Monday when the new episode came out. But it didn't have the impact that it did recently with everything that's going on. So it's sort of a perfect storm of everything that's going on in this country racially, just to trace it back. I mean, it's not just what happened in Minneapolis. It's that type of injustice has been going on for a long time. So I think it hit home with a lot of people for them to say, hey, you know, I didn't realize that was your family's history or that was your family's journey. And then they get curious about, they're asking questions, and they're worried about offending me by asking questions. And I explained to them, like, this is my family history. This story's been in my family for as long as I could, you know, retain a story. That's just my particular family's journey. And I usually follow that up with, if you ask 100 African Americans if they have either heard of a story like that or experienced it firsthand, their family or a friend, you know, pretty much the majority of them would say yes, especially back in my grandfather's time. It was, the timing was such that it resonated now versus 3 years ago when the podcast came out.
A few weeks ago, Tony let Keith know he was coming to Jacksonville to see Sally and his mother, and he wanted to meet Keith for the first time. It was important, he thought, to get to know Keith as a person and not to think of him as the guy whose uncles killed Tony's grandfather. So they met outdoors at a coffee shop, Keith, Tony, Tony's wife, for nearly 2 hours. It was a meeting they both described as profoundly important, even though, or because, little of the conversation was about how their family paths had crossed in a fatal, fateful way.
It went well. Now, we talked about a lot of things. We probably spent a fraction of that time. I would wager it was, you know, less than 25% of our conversation dealt with, you know, the podcast, my grandfather, my mother, et cetera. It was more of a kind of getting to know him outside of that. It was a good experience.
Final story. Some of you may know that in November 2018, we staged a Barry Truths live event at the Atlanta History Center. This fell within a week of Thanksgiving, so I kind of winced when I heard the space we'd reserved would hold 400 people. There's nothing more dispiriting than a paltry crowd in a large auditorium. The seats began filling pretty quickly and didn't stop until all 400 seats were occupied and people were standing in the back. That was a welcome surprise, and there were others. During the second segment of the evening, I invited Dorothy Nixon Williams to the stage to interview her. Now, keep in mind that the audience knew Dorothy only through the podcast. I mean, Entertainment Tonight doesn't exactly celebratize our Barry Truth subjects. This audience had only ever heard her voice. But as she walked onto the stage, she drew a spontaneous standing ovation that just kept going. It caught us both off guard and choked us up. And then there was this. In the months before Barry Truth's Live, I tried to obtain a copy of a photograph the Pittsburgh Courier's reporter-photographer, Alexander Rivera, took of the Isaiah Nixon family shortly after he was killed. It's an iconic image that will remind you of the work of Walker Evans. The black and white frame shows the family, some seated, some standing, in front of their farmhouse, flanked by her mother-in-law, Daisy Davis, and surrounded by her children. Sally Mama is in the center, holding her newborn, Isaiah Jr. On the porch behind them is Cotton in one of Isaiah Nixon's hats. The night before the Barry Truths Live event in November 2018, the late photographer's son, Dr. Eric McAllister Rivera, called me from Durham, North Carolina. He'd gotten my request, and yes, he said, he would be thrilled to make sure I received a print of the photograph. And he gave me his permission to frame it and present it as a gift to Sally for her 94th birthday, days later. I announced this at Barry Truth's and suggested that we sing Happy Birthday to Sally, record it, and present it to her along with the framed photograph. 400 people joined in.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sally. Happy birthday to you.
Sally Nixon was born on December 5, 1923. She died on July 25, 2020. She was 96. Her graveside funeral began at 10 a.m. on Saturday, July 31st, 2020, in Jacksonville. Now, why am I giving you all this detail? Because that, by serendipity, is exactly when I walked into the studio at WABE in Atlanta, 350 miles away, and began recording this special episode. By now, Sally Nixon has been laid to rest. This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. And this is my eulogy.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.